Case number 13-3015, United States of America v. Carl Michael Taylor, appellant. Mr. Axon for the appellant, Ms. Boyce for the appellee.
May it please the court, counsel. Tony Axon representing appellant Carl Taylor. I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal. Section 1B1.10B2A of the sentencing guidelines was promulgated in violation of the Sentencing Reform Act's administrative rulemaking requirements. And therefore, the district court should not have applied it against Mr. Taylor to find him ineligible for a sentence reduction pursuant to 18 U.S.C. Section 3582C2. Under the Sentencing Reform Act, policy statements and guidelines are different, and that matters because guidelines must be promulgated according to the administrative rulemaking requirements of the Act, and policy statements don't. A policy statement guides courts in implementing the guidelines and implementing sentences, and a guideline, on the other hand, determines the sentence that will be imposed and the length of imprisonment. And in Vietnam Veterans of America versus Secretary of the Navy, this court recognized the distinction between guidelines and policy statements and held that legislative rules bind the courts while interpretive rules or policy statements do not.
I thought after Booker, guidelines don't bind the court either.
That is correct. However, Section 1B1.10 is...
So what I'm saying is the distinction between guidelines and policy statements can't be their binding effect anymore.
I'm not sure that that's the case, because Section 1B1.10 has been considered a policy statement, but it has also been considered outside of it's not considered in the same context as the guidelines vis-a-vis Booker. Section 1B1.10.
I guess what I'm asking is, between your opening brief and your reply brief, I was unclear as to what your office's position was with respect to binding. In the opening brief, it sounded like you thought binding meant guideline, and that a policy statement couldn't be binding. And then in the reply brief, it was less clear about that. Is your point that if it's binding, it must be a policy statement? Is that what you were just saying? Or no.
No.
If it's binding, it must be a guideline.
Binding, it must be a guideline. Yes.
Even though most guidelines are not binding.
Most guidelines are not binding, but I think that it's helpful to look at 1B1.10 as though it is pre-Booker. Because that's the only framework we have.
What do you do with the statutory provision that specifically refers to this as a policy statement?
That's correct. Congress refers to it as a policy statement. The Sentencing Commission itself refers to it as a policy statement. But
there's also a statutory provision that presupposes that this policy statement would be binding.
That's correct.
3582C.
That's correct. And as this court said, a binding policy statement is not actually a policy statement. It's a rule.
Well, that's in the context of the APA, right?
Isn't it true that we're talking about an entirely different world than the APA?
I don't think that we are. I think that the Supreme Court has recognized that the APA applies to the guidelines.
The relationship between rules and policy statements under APA doesn't seem to apply here in this area, does it? Because Congress has given policy statements a impact that they wouldn't normally have under APA.
I think that that raises the separation of powers problems that I touch on, because if Congress can define something as a policy statement or as something that's not a rule but is going to be binding on the affected parties and be enforced as though it is a rule, and then delegate the authority to create that rule to an agency, which the Sentencing Commission is still an agency.
Yes, go ahead. So what?
And that agency does not have to comply with the ordinary procedures that the court in Mistretta found, I guess, that the APA procedures and 994P that the court in Mistretta found, I don't want to say justified, but informed the decision in Mistretta to find that the guidelines, that the delegation to the Sentencing Commission for creation of the guidelines was a proper delegation and not a violation of separation of powers.
Can I ask you a question? So before you go to separation of powers, are we at least on the same wavelength on the following issue, which is that Congress intended for policy statements in this area to be binding, and 3582C tells us that. And then you might have an argument, assuming that to be the case, that Congress couldn't have done that because that raises a separation of powers issue. But at least as to the predicate question, that under 3582C, Congress presupposed that policy statements on this issue would be binding. Are you in agreement with that, or do you disagree with that?
I'm in agreement mostly, and I say mostly because Congress didn't actually use the word binding. They said that they wanted the policies they required consistency with
right.
the policy statement.
Right.
And the policy statement here, the 1B1.10B2A that we're challenging, is actually binding. It did not have to be binding. It could have been a policy statement that said, just like the previous version, this is what you should do, this is how we are advising you. The Sentencing Commission went a step further and made it binding. And in doing so, I'm not sure that Congress anticipated that they would take that extra step, because that extra step had not been taken with regard to this policy statement before.
But is there anything that tells us that Congress would have thought that to be problematic?
There's nothing that tells us that Congress would have thought it would be problematic, and nothing that tells us that Congress specifically wanted 1B1.10 to be implemented in this way.
But there are parts of 1B1.10 even before that were binding, right? This particular part wasn't, but there were other parts that were. That is, the particular part we're talking about was an exception to the binding rule, right?
I'm not sure that 1B1.10 was binding before, because it was always.
Let me just read the first. I'm talking about 2A. In general, except as provided in subdivision B, which is the subdivision we're talking about, the court shall not reduce the defendant's term of imprisonment under 3582C2 to a term that is less than the minimum of the amended guideline range, right?
Yes.
That's binding. So unless you fall within the exception, it was binding, right?
That's the current version.
No, that's the 2008 version.
Okay. I'm sorry.
So you were saying that it used to not be binding, and now it's binding. But, in fact, the exception part wasn't binding, but the general rule was binding, right? I thought your point was that the exception used to say generally, and now the exception is just flat. It's just binding. But
the exception is what made it binding.
It's what made it binding with respect to your client, but with respect to other people who didn't fall in the exception anyway, it was binding.
It was binding insofar as it identified people who were eligible and then left it to the district court's discretion.
No, but it didn't. In Part A, there's no discretion at all. It just says except in with respect to part subdivision with the except with respect to the exception in B, the court shall not reduce below the amended guideline. So that means if you were someone who did not get a below the guidelines sentence before, you were stuck. You could only get
That's correct.
he amended, and that was binding. So when you say that Congress didn't expect there to be a binding exception because in the past there had a binding policy statement because in the past there hadn't been, that's not quite correct.
I think I would say that even the previous version was not binding because the court never had to give the reduction. All of this, the court still had to consider 3553, but it was still solely within the court's discretion to give the reduction, and that while the extent of the reduction was limited, the 3550, whatever 3553 factors existed at the original sentence, continued to have force under the old guideline. Under the new guideline, 3553 factors that existed in the original sentencing no longer had force. And in that sense, it was a greater limitation. And I guess we could say it was more binding. I will accept that this is binding in a sense, but
well, let me ask you about the to now move on for a moment on the separation of powers issue. Could you again? I was not completely clear about what your argument is. I take it you're not making a non-delegation doctrine argument. Is that right? Do you agree that there's a sufficiently intelligible principle here that this is not a violation of that doctrine?
That's correct.
All right. It seems to me there's two possible separation of powers arguments. And maybe there's a third or fourth that you were making. So one is that this violates the separation of powers because Congress didn't intend to give the commission this power, and so it's taking onto itself a power that it wasn't intended. Is that the nature of the separation of powers argument? Or alternatively, it's that even if Congress wanted to do this, to allow this through a binding policy statement, it couldn't do that because that violates the separation of powers. Is either one of those your arguments?
It's primarily the second argument. Congress couldn't do that because...
Well, the first argument is really not a separation of powers argument at all. It's a question of authority granted to the agency. The second one isn't a separation of powers argument. It goes to the question of whether Congress could delegate the authority to the agency. So that is your argument. I don't quite understand it. Would you explain it to me?
Certainly. Yeah. Congress couldn't, in order for, this is rulemaking. It's rulemaking because this is a guideline. And Congress is certainly permitted to delegate authority for rulemaking. But Congress has put prescriptions around that. And under the Sentencing Reform Act, one is notice and comment.
That again goes back to this first argument. That sounds like you're making an argument that violates the separation of powers because it's inconsistent with what Congress wanted. And I thought you told Judge Silberman that that's not the separation of powers argument.
It's really a question of authority. That's really the agency acting ultra vires. We have that all the time. That's not a separation of powers argument. And I agree. Well, so that's your second point. Well, what I'm sort of mystified is what is the separation of powers argument? It's not, as Judge Garland pointed out, you said it's not a delegation question. So what is it?
I would say that it is a delegation problem.
Unconstitutional delegation? Too much power given by Congress to an agency? Is that what you're suggesting? No intelligible principle?
There is no intelligible, yes.
That's
yes.
Your argument?
I wouldn't say that there's no intelligible principle for the sentencing guidelines as a whole, but 3582 is, when in Mistretta, when the Supreme Court discussed the intelligible principle, 3582 is not mentioned at all. This is a sentence reduction proceeding. And in that sense, Section 1B1.10 is, I don't want to say outside the guidelines, it's part of the guidelines, but there's no intelligible principle guiding reductions to sentences that have been already been imposed. And
so I thought your argument, I thought in the end, the third alternative, which I was going to offer you, I thought was, your argument was that Mistretta essentially holds that unless there's notice and comment as a constraint on the commission, it violates the separation of powers. That seemed to be the way you were construing Mistretta. Is that how I construe Mistretta. So is that the nub of your separation of powers argument, that without the constraint of notice and comment, Mistretta would have overturned the guidelines?
That is correct.
So the problem with that, of course, is that Mistretta lists about 10 different constraints, and notice and comment is just like one subset of one set of constraints.
That's correct.
Why do we think that notice and comment, I mean, lots of agencies didn't have rulemaking power at all. They could proceed by adjudication, and therefore there weren't notice and comment requirements. A lot of agencies don't, NLRB doesn't hardly ever, maybe not at all, I don't know, maybe there's
twice.
Recent, twice, has ever proceeded by rule. They just proceed by adjudication. Why is notice and comment not only essential but dispositive element of separation of powers?
Because it provides accountability to Congress in the same way that 994P does. And this court and the Supreme Court.
Why does notice and comment provide attribution to Congress? I don't quite get that. It's to the public, not to Congress. Most agencies who enter into notice and comment, the last thing they want to hear is anything from Congress.
I suppose it provides accountability to the public and works in conjunction with 994P to provide accountability to Congress so that the public is able to comment
So you think Mistretta would have been unconstitutional if the Sentencing Commission had authority to issue interpretive rules but not notice and comment rules?
I think that there's no way to know, but we do know that was a factor that was considered.
But I thought what was going on in Mistretta is that was a factor that was considered in service of the proposition that the commission is not a court. And so if you take away notice and comment, you're still left with the realization, I think, that the commission, arguably left with the realization that the commission still is not a court. And so the reason that the Supreme Court mentioned that factor in Mistretta still continues to exist here, notwithstanding that notice and comment is taken out of the equation. But maybe there's something else to there.
Well, I think you do run into another separation of powers problem, and that's that the commission, allowing this to stand, encroaches upon judges' prior findings regarding this individual defendant. And I accept that Mistretta lists many factors, and it's impossible to tell what is the dispositive factor that would have made the guidelines unconstitutional or had them violate separation of powers. But I don't think it's a stretch to say that that allowing the Sentencing Commission to pass guidelines without notice and comment and to affect prior sentences imposed by district judges certainly makes them seem more like a court. certainly makes them seem more as though they are overruling decisions that have previously been made. And the whole the rationale under Dillon was that facts had already been determined. That's why Dillon found that it could be a binding guideline, a binding policy statement, and that Booker was not implicated because the sentencing court had already made the factual determinations necessary to apply this.
Well,
so that there was no.
When you say that, you're referring to the sentencing court's deciding that there was a justification for going below the guidelines. Is that what you mean?
Yes.
But that was before a justification for going below the then guidelines. We don't have any idea what the district court would do with respect to going below the amended guidelines, right? The district court's never made a factual determination or any other kind of determination that going below the amended guidelines would be appropriate, because that hasn't happened yet, right?
Well, I think if a district court went below the guidelines in an original sentencing, it gave reasons for that. And if those reasons have the same applicability with regard to the amended guidelines, the district court should be allowed to effectuate, give effect to those reasons.
Well, in this case, if I recollect, this is one where the district court went below because of some substantial assistance or something, right? Questionable,
yes.
But nonetheless substantial assistance, and went below a guideline of X months, saying that you deserve a lower sentence than X months. But now the amended guidelines provide X minus Y months. The court's never made a determination that that assistance was sufficient to go below X minus Y months, has it? The commission isn't overruling that kind of determination.
No, the court didn't, but the commission doesn't speak in terms of months. It speaks in terms of sentence structure. It speaks in terms of guidelines and guideline provisions, and essentially says take two level. Took two levels off of offense levels. So the only entity that would know whether it already considered factors that the commission is considering in reducing offense levels by two levels would be the original sentencing court. And the commission is has removed through this new amendment the ability of the sentencing court to make that decision, to rely on reasons that it already gave.
Are there further questions? No. All right, we'll hear from the government.
May it please the Court, Sarah Boyce for the United States. Appellant's argument stands and falls based on the answer to one question, whether the Sentencing Commission has the power to promulgate binding policy statements without having to comply with the administrative rulemaking requirements. The answer to that question must be yes, that the Sentencing Commission has that power. Appellant invokes numerous principles for administrative law, but as Judge Silverman, you said, this is an entirely different world than the APA. As the statute itself says, as the statute's legislative history says, and as this court has repeatedly recognized, the well-settled principles of administrative law are of limited application in the sentencing context. In the end, appellant's argument cannot overcome the clear statutory text of the Sentencing Reform Act or the Supreme Court's holding in Dillon. Chief Judge Garland, I'd like to begin exactly where you began, which is to refute the notion that either before Booker or after Booker, the distinction between guidelines and policy statements was their binding nature. Before Booker, the Supreme Court had two different decisions in which it held, first, that policy statements could be binding, and second, that commentary could be binding. And obviously, after Booker, there no longer can be a distinction drawn between guidelines as being binding and policy statements as not being binding. All of this is drawn from the text, Judge Srinivasan, as you noted. 3582C2 is clear that Congress contemplated the fact that policy statements would be binding on district courts in sentencing modification proceedings which are a narrow exception to the usual rule of the finality of a court's judgment. If I could turn your attention.
Do you read these provisions then to mean that a measure that encompasses the material that's encompassed by this policy statement has to be done by a policy statement, or that it permissibly can be done by a policy statement?
Your Honor, I think there would be a legitimate argument that this could not be done by a guideline simply because 994A, which is on A5 of the addendum, says that guidelines will generally address the sentence to be imposed by a district court. And in this case, as the Supreme Court said in Dillon, a sentence has already been imposed. The district court just has limited discretion whether to tinker with that sentence. But I think the more important point is if the commission were to try to do this in a guideline, there would not be anything that would bootstrap that guideline in the sentence modification context, because 3582C2 says nothing about guidelines and instead refers only to a policy statement. The only way guidelines come into play at all in the sentence modification context is if 1B110 references them somewhere in its text. Another point I'd like to touch on, Chief Judge Garland, is something that you brought up with respect to the additional binding nature of 1B110 in the 2008 version and before. The Commission first promulgated 1B110 in 1989, and even then it was binding on district courts in two ways. First, it was binding in a way that has always been binding without change, and that's that 1B110 has always served as the key that unlocks a district court's discretion to reduce or modify a defendant's sentence. As the Supreme Court discussed in Dillon, no one disputes the fact that 1B110 as a policy statement may be binding insofar as a district court has no discretion to reduce a sentence that is not listed based on an amendment that is not listed in 1B110C. So no one disputes that, at least in that regard, this policy statement in particular can and has always been binding. But even with respect to the part of 994U that authorizes the commission to specify by what amount a sentence may be reduced, the district court's discretion has long been restricted. The very first version of 1B110 said that a district court may never reduce a defendant's sentence by more than the number of months that the maximum sentence had been reduced in the amended guidelines range. So from day one of this, the commission has exercised some amount of power or authority to bind district courts. The degree to which the district courts are bound has changed over time. They shifted and took the specific number of months restriction out. Then they added in this departure language, ultimately the variance language, and then took it away. But the point remains that, to some extent, the courts have always been bound in terms of the discretion and the number of months that they may reduce.
Can I ask you a question about this? So it's beyond the four corners of the legal dispute before us, but just for my own edification. As I understand it, the reason the commission further restricted the availability of relief is because of a supposition that there was difficulty in understanding the difference between in discerning the distinction between a variance and a departure.
Yes.
And why is that? Is that actually something that's difficult to identify? It doesn't seem to me that it would be.
No, it doesn't seem to me difficult to identify. I do know that in 2007 and 2008, when the commission was considering the prior amendment, that was something that was discussed, is that in light of Booker, courts were getting confused about whether or not a sentence modification was authorized, and they were trying to address that problem. I also think, however, though, that in addition to that issue of perhaps a complication and misunderstanding and distinguishing between departures and variances, the commission was also very concerned with making sure that the courts were not overwhelmed with a huge number of 3582C2 motions. The 2008 1B110 version was amended in conjunction with the first revision to the crack cocaine base offense levels, as I'm sure you're aware, and the courts were flooded with over 25,000 3582C2 motions. The commission was concerned that in this case, when it amended it again, the courts not be too overwhelmed by too many people coming in, because they expected that there would be at least 12,000 offenders who would apply for an additional reduction, even those who had already gotten a reduction in the first instance. So to some extent, these perpetual adjustments to 1B110 are part of the retroactivity calculus that the commission necessarily must undertake to make sure that the courts will not be overwhelmed, that these narrow proceedings that are not constitutionally compelled do not, in the end, undermine finality and burden the courts in a way that they cannot sustain.
Can I turn your attention to the constitutional argument presented based on Mistretta? Isn't it fair to say that Mistretta is a bit of a grab bag of disparate considerations?
You mean insofar as the court lists?
It justifies the constitutionality of the sentencing commission?
Yes, I would agree that it is a grab bag.
So why then shouldn't we take seriously the argument if you take out one string of the grab bag, you may take out the whole bag?
I think for two reasons, Your Honor. The first is that, as Judge Srinivasan mentioned, notice and comment is only mentioned in the context of the Supreme Court listing a grab bag of factors, as you said, that distinguish the commission from a judicial authority or judicial branch. And it's I'm not quite sure why the court used notice and comment to distinguish it. But it's certainly true that taking notice and comment away does not make the commission any more.
If you understood Ms. Stradic, what is the core of Ms. Stradic then? If the notice and comment is really not important, what is the core concern of Ms. Stradic?
Well, I think there are several core concerns in Mistretta. In that particular part, they're obviously talking about whether or not Congress has aggrandized the judicial branch, and ultimately they come to the conclusion that this is not a court, it's just strangely located in the judicial branch. I do think it's important that in that discussion, the major analog that they compare the Sentencing Commission's ability to promulgate guidelines and policy statements to is the Rules Enabling Act, where the courts have the ability to set their own rules and procedures. And, of course, until the late 80s and early 90s, those rules did not have to be promulgated by way of notice and comment. So obviously notice and comment is not a critical factor whereby if you pull one strand out, the entire tower will topple over.
Well, but if you view Mistretta in that way, Mistretta has first, second, third, I guess three different reasons overall, one of which is that it's not a court, right, that the commission's not a court.
Right.
And although there may be a lot of strands in Mistretta, there's only two strands explaining why it's not a court. One is that the commission is fully accountable to Congress, unlike a court. And second, the Administrative Procedure Act. So now we're talking about not pulling one of ten strings, but we're talking about pulling one of two strings on the triad that supports the entire argument. Why isn't eliminating one of the two strings on the reason for it not being a court, which is, of course, essential to the overall decision? If you knock out that one leg, you've knocked out the whole decision.
Well, Your Honor, first of all, if I may, with all due respect, tinker with that slightly.
You don't need any respect.
I believe in Mistretta. They named, first, the fact that Congress may step in and intervene and overrule policy statements and guidelines, which is, of course, true here. They mentioned the fact that the president may remove members of the commissioner. That's still true here.
True.
And then third, they also reference these notice and comment procedures.
Right. And they also cite Montesquieu, I guess. Maybe that's the fourth.
Yes, absolutely. Mm-hmm. So to the extent you do think notice and comment as a one-third of those factors is important, I do think it's important to emphasize the fact that notice and comment took place here. To the extent possible, the Sentencing Commission still attempts to undergo notice and comment for every single policy statement and every single guideline. So to the extent
notice... You're not resting on that, right? If we were to conclude that there wasn't sufficient notice and comment here, you wouldn't lose the case.
No, absolutely not, because notice 994X is very clear that notice and comment is not...
So we have to go on the assumption that there was no notice and comment here for the moment.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
And that would bring me back to my previous point, which is that it's one of several strands, and again... That list of factors did seem kind of strange and idiosyncratic in light of the overall discussion as to whether or not this was a court.
Can I ask you, I have a statutory question. 994U, which is the one that says if the commission reduces the term of imprisonment, it shall specify in what circumstances and by what amount the sentences of prisoners serving terms of imprisonment for the offense may be reduced. That's the one that sounds like it can specify bindingness.
Absolutely.
But it doesn't say by policy statements.
No, Your Honor. The part of the Sentencing Reform Act that suggests that this needs to be done in a policy statement is 994A2, which delineates between guidelines and policy statements based on their subject matter, and 994A2C specifically says that guidance that instructs district courts as to the appropriate use of sentence modification proceedings should be in the form of a policy statement.
Why does T, which precedes U, specifically refer to policy statements, and V, which follows U, specifically refer to policy statements, but U, which is the key here, doesn't refer to policy statements?
Your Honor, I'm not sure why Congress drew that distinction in the legislative history. Discussing 994U, it discusses policy statements in the same way that it does for T and V.
Scrivener's error?
I suppose. That was something that was raised in the briefs in Dillon that was put forward as an argument to distinguish those, and although the Supreme Court did not discuss that in any length, it appears that they did not consider that dispositive in terms of the meaning of 994U.
Further questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
We have time for the no time. We'll give you a couple more minutes if you'd like.
I'll be brief. I would just reiterate that this court should invalidate the current version of 1B1.2A. Policy statements in general, it makes sense that a policy statement would be used to reduce a sentence that has already been imposed. However, once the commission is using a policy statement and seeks to change something that the district court previously relied on, or eliminate something that the district court previously relied on, it is fundamentally altering the structure of the district court sentence. And separate and aside from any separation of powers problem between Congress and the Sentencing Commission, it is creating a separation of powers problem between the commission and the court.
Thank you. We'll take the case under submission.